Hello everyone, I would like to welcome you to today's Accessibility Online webinar series. My name is Jessica Madrigal. I'm from the ADA National Network. We do this series as a collaborative program between the ADA National Network and the U.S. Access Board. So I'm just going to walk you through some instructions on how to use our platform today, and then I will pass it over to today's speakers. Listening to the webinar, obviously one of the reasons why you are here today. So our audio is being broadcast through your computer. Make sure that your speakers are turned on or your headphones are plugged in. If you're having sound quality problems, you can check your audio controls by going through the Audio Wizard, which you can access by using the microphone icon on the right side of the audio and video panel. If you prefer to listen via telephone, we do have a number for you to use today. You can dial 712-432-3100, and the passcode for that is 930098. Just a reminder that this is not a toll-free number, but you are welcome to use it if you prefer. We are able to offer the webinar to mobile users using an iPhone, an iPad, a Kindle Fire, or an Android device. You can listen to the session using the Blackboard Collaborate mobile app, which is available free download from the Apple Store, Google Play, or Amazon. Real-time captioning is provided to you today through our webinar platform. You can access the closed captioning screen by using the CC icon. On the top right-hand corner of your audio and visual screen. And once you've selected that, you can resize the captioning window, change the font size, and also save the transcript. You can also submit questions in the chat area text box, or press Control M and enter text in the chat area. If you're connected via a mobile device, you can submit questions in the chat area within your app. And if you're listening by phone, you can submit the questions to webinars@accessibilityonline.org. You can customize your view by resizing the whiteboard where the presentation is going to be shown, by using the fit page and pulling that down to customize. You can choose your size there. And you can also reposition your chat, audio and visual, and participant panels by detaching using the icon with the lines in the upper right corner of each panel and then resizing those to your preference. If you experience any kind of technical difficulties, you can send a private chat message to the host, which is me, by clicking on the Great Lakes ADA from the participant list. You can then type your comment or your trouble question in the text box. Or you can email us at webinars@accessibilityonline.org or call us at 877-232-1990 and we'd be happy to assist you over the telephone. So without further ado, I'm going to pass this over to our presenters today, and Peggy Greenwell will be moderating the session for us. Peggy, here you go.
Thanks, Jessica, and welcome everyone to our session on accessible fire alarms. This is the third session that we've recently held on our reference standards. As you know, in the 2010 ADA standard and then the Architectural Barriers Act accessibility standard, when it comes to the requirements for fire alarms, we reference the NFPA 72. So today we have Jim Peck from the board who's going to be discussing the scoping provisions or more about where fire alarms are required, where accessible fire alarms are required, and a few of the technical requirements. And then Lee Richardson, we're pleased to have him with us today, who's with NFPA, we'll be going into more of the details about what the standards actually call for, the technical requirements within NFPA 72. So just a little background on Jim and Lee. Jim, as you know, is a frequent speaker at the in the webinar series, and he's been with the board since the early 90s, so he's a veteran staff here, master's degree in architecture from the University of Maryland, and he's also a member of the National Fire Protection Association and an associate member of the American Institute of Architects. Lee Richardson is a senior electrical engineer with NFPA, where he's responsible for NFPA 72, the National Fire Alarm and Signaling Code, and NFPA 720, the standard for the installation of carbon monoxide detection and warning equipment. His responsibilities have also included playing an active role in the staffing duties for the code-making panel, processing of proposals and comments for the recent additions of NFPA 70, the National Electrical Code. So without further hesitation, I'm going to turn it over to Jim to begin the presentation.
Okay, so good afternoon. We're going to be talking, first off, about the scoping. This is basically where and when alarms are required or fire alarm systems are required. Let's go to slide 13. Pretty much the ADA and the Architectural Barriers Act standards are pretty similar in the fact that they don't really require things. They require that when things are provided, they have to meet a certain accessibility standard or requirement as per the code. And fire alarm systems are not any different. It's basically where fire alarm systems are provided, where they provide audible alarm coverage, then the alarms have to comply with the scoping provisions in section 215.1 and F215.1. Generally, where fire alarm systems are required is pretty much by local building or fire or life safety codes. That's where you get the actual requirement to put in a system or not to put in a system. The accessibility requirements come in behind that and say, okay, once you've provided it, now it has to meet the standard as far as accessibility is concerned. Also, local codes will determine coverage of the area. In other words, they'll tell you which areas are required to be covered by a fire alarm system and which areas may not necessarily be required to have a fire alarm system that covers that specific area. An example I have heard and talked about in technical assistance is in some places you have a very large, let's say, shopping mall. The fire code in that jurisdiction required that the general large public areas of the mall had to be covered by a fire alarm system, but the individual tenants or the little shops off the mall were not required to be covered by that system. Even though you could have heard the alarm or seen the visual alarm in those areas, the code didn't require the coverage to extend to those tenancies in that specific jurisdiction. So the jurisdiction that you're talking about will sort of tell you where the alarm system has to cover. In that, basically, when you design a fire alarm system, you start with the audible requirements. In other words, you design a certain decibel or sound level for an area, and if it's intended to bleed through walls and cover walls, rooms, let's say, beyond a corridor and be heard in a space beyond that corridor, then in certain circumstances you may have to put a visual alarm in that area to meet the coverage. One of the questions asked about whether or not we require alarms in stairs. And like I say, that would be up to either a specific requirement in NFPA 72 or a specific requirement by a local fire or life safety code where it says we want you to extend the coverage to the stairway as well, the fire stair, as well as the public or common use area. So let's go to slide 14. There is an exception for existing facilities. The old standard, the 91 standard, the ADA, and the old Uniform Federal Accessibility Standard basically didn't differentiate between fire alarm systems when you did an alteration to an existing facility. It said if a fire alarm system, part of it, a visual alarm or an audible alarm was part of the alteration, you had to make it accessible to the maximum extent feasible as part of that alteration. We put in an exception in the new document that says in existing facilities, visible alarms are not required except where an existing fire alarm system is upgraded, replaced, or a new fire alarm system is installed where none existed previously. So in other words, you don't get the requirement to meet new construction and an alteration to the maximum extent feasible still, unless you are dealing with the entire system as a whole. In other words, you're not going to be required to, you know, go into one room and try to figure out how to put in a visual alarm for the if you're only altering that one space. And that has a lot to do with the fact that visible fire alarm appliances take a certain energy requirement or power requirement. And in order to provide that visible alarm, you may have to, as far as an existing building, upgrade your electrical system as far as the power that's necessary to run the whole system. So that seemed to go beyond the scope of work of an alteration with an existing facility. So we limited it to when you're dealing with the entire system. We also had a question that had to do with this that basically said, could you use a portable system when you were altering or upgrading or dealing with an entire system in an existing building? That would be a function of more what the Department of Justice would require in their regulations. They talk about maintenance of accessible features and allowing you to interrupt service to deal with maintenance and repair and all that kind of good stuff. And that would be more along the lines of what they would require as far as your obligation to provide an accessible any kind of alarm system. It would also necessarily, you probably want to talk to your local code guy, because if you're turning off the entire system of the entire building, they may or may not allow you to do that and still occupy the building while you're doing that. So that's something you might want to check with local code. So let's move on to slide 15. Now, once you are providing a fire alarm system, where are you required to provide accessible appliances as far as visual alarms and audible alarms that meet the requirement? Any public or common use area, that's any area that's open to the general public, or any common use area for employees that the purpose of that area is not solely for work, in other words, employees engaged at labor. All those areas must be, if they are protected by a fire alarm system, have to meet the requirement in new construction or, like I say, in an alteration when you're dealing with the entire system. Slide 16. And here are just basically two images. One is an overhead view of a lobby area in, like I say, a hotel or something that's clearly a public space where the public is allowed to come in and mingle and move around. That space would have to meet the requirements for visible and audible alarms if a system was provided. The second image is what I'm going to call an employee break room, because it has a little kitchenette and there's a table, and it's, I understand it looks a little more executive than it does anything else. But let's call it, for sake of argument, an employee break room or lounge or lunch room. This is an area where employees are not engaged at labor. They're doing other things. They're eating their lunch. They're just sort of chatting with each other and all that kind of stuff. Those areas are required to be meet new construction requirements if it's new construction, and et cetera. Slide 17. The other area is basically where we're talking about over the requirement is employee work areas. And employee work area is a defined term in the standards. And this is basically where employees are engaged solely at labor or doing work. Basically, it says where employees' work areas have audible alarm coverage, the wiring system shall be designed so that visible alarms complying with 702 can be integrated into the alarm system. And I'm going to talk briefly for a minute about common use, that phrase, and how it can sort of apply to both work areas and non-work areas. There can be an employee work area that is also a common use area. It doesn't necessarily have to be divided up into specific workstations or work cubicles or whatever. It could be common use, but as long as the only thing that goes on in that common use area is employees engaged in labor, the employee work area section or requirements trump. Those requirements apply in any place where the only thing that goes on is employees engaged in labor. The only time that you get the new construction requirement for common use areas is when it's not an employee work area. So that's a very important distinction. One of the questions we got was, is the fire alarm panel required to be accessible? And the answer is no, because that's basically used by employees of the building only, or by fire rescue personnel which come in and have to monitor the situation. So that's never used by the general public. It's not, even if it is part of a common use area, it's only dealing with work, and therefore it's not required to be accessible. We had some other questions which had to do with can you use portable systems in the employee area, or can you use text-based devices like, you know, pagers or someone's computer or someone's cell phone to be notified of the alarm signal? And that's where we get into the reason that we only required wiring into the employee work areas. We assumed that once you stepped into an employee work area, that the standard didn't sort of apply anymore. It's except to some minor degree for common use circulation paths. Those areas get picked up by the Title I employment discrimination regulation that's administered by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And basically, you're providing a specific employee with a disability with reasonable accommodation in that area. So technically, I can't tell you that you're required to have a hardwired alarm in every work area where somebody with a hearing impairment wants one. It has to be reasonable and all that kind of good stuff. However, you have to sort of ask yourself, what is the standard of protection that you're providing to everybody else with that alarm system? Are you providing an equal standard of protection, you know, to an employee? If you say that we're going to give you, you're going to either use a text-based system that requires you to either be at your computer or use your cell phone or some other device that receives this text-based alarm, everybody else in the building doesn't have a requirement that they have to maintain some piece of equipment. They deal with the system. You're now sort of shifting the requirement to the employee, which is may not be what is intended. So I would say that the standard protection you should probably want to strive for would be NFPA 72, which requires a hardwired system. So let's move on to slide 18. And again, this is a picture of what could be a sort of typical a building code office where the public can come in. Obviously, the stuff in the foreground on the foreground side of the counter is the public zone. That would have to meet the requirements for full accessibility as far as visual and audible alarms. On the other side of that counter is what I would call a work area. It's an employee work area. It's got, you know, probably got tables to look at plans. It's got, you know, the folios that have all the plats and all that kind of good stuff in it. It's probably a common use area. It may not be divided up into work stations. It may just be one big area where the employees can work. But it is, in fact, a work area. Even though it's common use, it would still meet the definition, and you would only be required to bring the wiring to that area, and then somebody with a disability could request a visual alarm be hooked into the system if they're working in that area. Slide 19. Excuse me. One of the specific areas that require alarms is in transient lodging facilities. The language reads, guest rooms required to comply with section 224.4 or F224.4 shall provide alarms complying with 702. And I know that sounds like a requirement, but we'll talk about it when we get into the technical requirements. It's still where provided. The thing about transient lodging facilities, hotels, motels, and that kind of thing, is most fire codes and building codes require alarm systems in those areas anyway. So for the most part, you're going to have a requirement one way or the other. Now, 224 is basically the sections of the scoping that covers the transient lodging rooms required to have communication features only. It's not necessarily the ones with for wheelchairs. It's provided mostly for folks who are deaf or hard of hearing. Slide 20. And again, this is just a typical transient lodging hotel room or motel room, which has a visual alarm in it. And NFPA 72 has specific requirements for these types of rooms, which bump up the features as regards to the candela and those kind of things. And there's also some new requirements that are coming down the pike for NFPA 72 that I'm going to let Lee talk about, which I'm pretty excited about. That's the stuff that's coming up now. Anyway, this gives you an idea of the typical requirements in that kind of room. Slide 21. Another place where we specifically require alarms, if they're provided, is in residential facilities. Again, if you provide an alarm system in a residential facility and the alarm system is intended to be used in the residential dwelling unit as well, you have to meet the requirements in section 809.5, which is the requirements for residential dwelling units with communications features specifically. And again, that's a 2% requirement, just like it is in the, or similar to what's in transient lodging. There's a table for transient lodging, but in residential facilities, it's a 2% requirement for those rooms. Slide 22. So now I'm going to talk very briefly about some of the technical requirements, and specifically about some of the things that are required in Chapter 702. Slide 23. So when you have a fire alarm system, the technical requirements shoot you to Section 702 in the standard. And this is basically where we say fire alarm systems shall have permanently installed audible and visible alarms complying with NFPA 72, the 1999 or the 2002 edition. We recently, one of the questions had to do with hotels and can you still use the portable kits. And for new construction, you're specifically required to provide a fixed system. The Department of Justice in their appendix to their Title III regulation in A36.406(b) basically specified that the standards apply to fixed elements. So you're no longer allowed in new construction to use a portable system. You have to have a hardwired built-in system that meets the requirements. Now the other thing is we reference specific editions of NFPA 72, 1999 or 2002, and we're already up to, I'm not sure exactly where we are, Lee can tell you better, 2009 or 2012, and anyway. So the question is, well, why don't you just reference NFPA 72 and it'll be whatever the new edition is? Well, we can't do that in the federal government. In the federal government, when we write regulations, first of all, if we just said NFPA 72 without a year, a specific edition, we'd be turning over our regulatory requirements as far as what we were charged to do under the ADA and the Architectural Barriers Act over to NFPA, which may or may not be a good thing, but we're not allowed to do it. The other thing is the Administrative Procedures Act requires federal facilities or federal regulators to give the public notice and give the public an opportunity to comment on any proposed changes in a regulation. So we would put out a proposed rule for public comment. If we were to just say NFPA 72, then we would not be providing that to the public. NFPA would change the standard or the edition, and then we would basically not be providing the public with their notice or giving them an opportunity to comment on those changes. So that's why we specifically have to specify a specific edition. Now, the next question is, can we use the newer newer editions, even though you specify 2002 as the latest edition? And the answer is, under equivalent facilitation in the standard, you're always allowed to do something that provides substantially equivalent or greater access. So as long as that new edition does not provide less access than the standard we reference, you would be able to use equivalent facilitation to use that new edition, which is for the most part okay, and they may have more stringent requirements than the current standard. Slide 24. So again, when you have a system, you have to have both visual and audible parts to it. Now this can be done with an appliance that combines both of those together, as this one does. It's basically an audible and a visual compliance combination appliance. Slide 25. You can separate the two appliances and do speakers in the ceiling, which are your audible requirements, and give you a decibel requirement for that area, which will also, again, how you design the amount of loudness or decibel level for that speaker will determine what kind of coverage that specific speaker, what areas that speaker covers, and then you'd have to put additional visual alarms. Slide 26, which can be just simple visual alarms that can be placed around all the areas that audible appliance covers, so you get the appropriate coverage as necessary for the spaces required. Slide 27. Now in the technical requirements in 702.1, there's an exception that reads, fire alarm systems in medical care facilities shall be permitted to be provided in accordance with industry practice. And what does that mean? That means basically, and NFPA sort of spells a lot of this out in its requirements as well, that in a hospital situation, there may be areas that you don't want an audible or a visual alarm to go off for whatever reason. Usually it's because the patients in that area can't evacuate under their own power. So for downstairs in the lobby where the gift shop is and the administration and the check-in, yeah, that area will probably have to meet the requirements for audible and visual alarms because that's a public and common use space. And everybody that's sort of down there is sort of ambulating around and moving around and can get out on their own speed. But let's say upstairs in the intensive care unit or in the cardiac care unit, you don't want an alarm going off in that area. So what happens is the industry practice, and again, NFPA 72, allows the staff in that area to be alerted, and then they sort of take control of moving people from one location to another if necessary to be more protected, usually using a horizontal exit in the hospitals, which are usually required, and then they wait for the fire rescue personnel to show up, and if the fire can't be contained, then they start evacuating people out of the building. But yeah, it's a little bit different in medical care facilities when you have a lot of folks that basically cannot evacuate under their own steam. We had a question about operating rooms, and I would probably consider an operating room an employee work area. It's open to the public in the sense that you come in not under your own steam usually, and are sort of dealt with by the staff. And again, industry practice, I guess, would allow you to alert staff in that location, not necessarily requiring an audible and visual alarm in that area. So let's go to slide 28. Again, transient lodging facilities. Again, this is where we say in section 806.3, where emergency system warning systems are provided. Again, it's where provided, even though it sounded in the scoping like it was required all the time, it's just where provided. But again, most codes will require it in transient lodging facilities. Anyway, alarms complying with section 702 have to be provided. Slide 29. Residential facilities in section 809.5.1 says where building fire alarm system is provided, The system wiring shall be extended to a point within the residential dwelling unit to a vicinity of the residential dwelling unit smoke detection system. So in a residential facility, you've got sort of two zones. You've got sort of the common use and to some degree public zone, the hallways, the lobbies, common use laundry facilities or common use day rooms or television rooms or things like that. Those spaces are required to meet the requirements of NFPA 72 as far as the building system is concerned, which means audible and visual alarm systems. But when you get into the unit itself, basically we require that the wiring extend into the space so that the individual in that space, if they so desire, can have an alarm that's connected to the building fire alarm system provided inside their unit. And so that allows the unit to sort of deal with that issue on a case-by-case basis. We had a sort of a question that sort of asked how you differentiate between the public and the unit and how that interfaces with smoke detection. We'll sort of get to that in just a minute. Slide 30. Again, basically it says where alarm appliances are provided within the unit as part of the building alarm system, then they have to comply. So in other words, it's saying once you provide that alarm in the unit that's connected to the building alarm system, then NFPA 72 kicks in because we're requiring you to comply with Section 702, which requires compliance with NFPA 72. Slide 31. Section 809.5.2 talks about residential dwelling unit smoke detection systems have to comply with NFPA 72. Again, it depends on what NFPA 72 requires with regards to the system in that space. If they require a hardwired system, then it would have to meet the requirements of both visual and audible compliance or appliances. It may be that you have single station battery operated smoke detectors. Those aren't really considered fixed or built in as far as we're concerned for a lot of reasons, primarily because a 9-volt battery just will not power a visual alarm. You just really have to have something that's hardwired to provide a visual alarm that meets the requirements necessary to alert someone in the space. You are required, and this is in both ours and NFPA 72, that when one unit, one smoke detector goes off, it has to trigger all the other smoke detectors in that dwelling unit. But again, the resident may request a hardwired appliance, in which case then you have to meet the standard, slide 32. All visual alarm appliances provided within the residential dwelling unit for smoke detection shall be activated. That's what I just talked about. I'm sorry. Okay, that's basically connecting all those smoke detection appliances together so that when one goes off, they all go off. Slide 33. Now, if you provide a hardwired smoke alarm with you basically sort of get into the requirement of now you're sort of getting into the ability to provide the power that provides the visual strobe, and that is allowed to be done, obviously. It would have to meet the requirements. One thing about this visual strobe, it can be used as the same appliance that's connected to the building alarm system. So in other words, you could make this a dual purpose. It would go off, it would alarm if the building alarm goes off. It would also alarm in the sense of the smoke alarm system, which may not trigger the building requirement. Usually the NFPA says it doesn't unless it's specifically required by the administrative authority having jurisdiction. But anyway, I'll let Lee get into a little bit more to that if he has time. And so let me move on to slide 34. And we had a question about this, and I just put this in because it sort of gets sometimes gets lost. This is not really what we think about as visual and audible alarms, but you do have to have an alarm pole station. And alarm poles have always been covered by the standard, either the 91 or the 2010, as a either controller operating mechanism in 91 or as an operable part as far as the new standard. It's covered by scoping provisions for operable parts in Section 205 and F205, and the technical requirements are in Section 309, which is the building block section. And it's basically required to be operable with one hand, not requiring tight grasping, pinching, or twisting of the wrist, and have a maximum force required of 5 pounds to activate. There are pulls on the market which are a two-phase, if you will. You either push something in and then pull something out, or in certain circumstances, like in schools, they like to try to mitigate false alarms, so they put a cover over the alarm, which once you pull the cover off, the cover sounds an alarm, a local alarm right there to tell somebody that the fire alarm has been pulled out. So it was those were used to attempt to keep kids from pulling in false alarms. Now, when I say operable with one hand, I don't necessarily mean operable. You can't have a two-stage operation. You just have to be able to operate it with one hand for each stage. What do I mean by that? Some of the designs for the cases that go on the fire alarm pull box or pull station have a spring-loaded requirement. So if you lift it up and you let go of it, the spring would push it back down. So that might not be operable with one hand because you every time you get it up, you couldn't get your hand underneath it to get to the pull before it closed again. You would have to have a situation where the case was operable with one hand, it pulls up, it stays there. Or in certain circumstances, I've seen the type where you actually pull it off the wall and they're connected with a wire that keeps it from being keeps it from walking away. In any event, that's one operation. But then you're allowed to go and use the pull for the fire alarm pull in a second operation, which is operable with one hand. That would be allowed. So now, slide 35. So now I am going to step back and turn it over to Lee, and he's going to give you some explanations for some of the technical requirements in NFPA 72.
Okay, next slide, please. 36. Basically, this is going to be about the requirements contained in the 2002 edition of the National Fire Alarm Code. In the area of requirements for notification appliances. Of course, the National Fire Alarm Code covers lots of other areas, detection and other areas, but we're going to focus on notification appliances in this case. Slide 37. So what I have here is a little diagram that tries to answer the question, what determines the need to have a fire alarm system or occupant notification and that sort of thing. So one thing to keep in mind is NFPA 72 is essentially an installation standard. It gets its marching orders from laws, building codes or occupancy codes or ADA. And there are many aspects to what these laws, codes, and ADA would require. For example, the requirement to have a fire alarm system is one thing. In some occupancies, it's not required. In other occupancies, it's required only if you have a certain capacity of population. Other aspects that are covered under that are the need to have manual initiation capability, in other words, pull stations located throughout the facility, and so on. But one of the things they also typically cover is requirements for occupant notification. In other words, typically for a typical building, you have to, if you have a fire alarm system, you usually have to have notification to your occupants to to evacuate or relocate or whatever is suitable for that building. And so all of those features come from the laws or building codes, occupancy codes, or ADA, and that determines the need for occupant notification. And then you go to the NFPA 72 for the installation of that equipment. So that's what we're going to talk about next. Slide 38, please.
Lee, I hate to interrupt you here, but a lot of people are having trouble hearing you. So is there any way that you can increase your volume or speak louder?
All right. Is that better? I will try to speak louder. How's that?
That's good. When you speak just like you did, that's a lot better.
All right. Okay. Can we go to slide 38? Thank you. Okay. There are codes and there are standards. NFPA codes are NFPA 101, the Life Safety Code, NFPA 5000, Building Construction and Safety Code, NFPA 1, the Fire Code. Those are higher level codes that are adopted into law. And within those codes are contained references to installation standards like NFPA 13 for sprinkler systems and NFPA 72, the National Fire Alarm and Signaling Code. And despite the name of NFPA 72 using the word code, it really is just an installation standard. Slide 39. The next question that arises is what edition of NFPA 72 is to be used, and that is going to be the addition being enforced. And it, as I mentioned before, the higher level codes will refer to that. In the case of ADA, it refers specifically to the 1999 and the 2002 edition. And often an AHJ will allow you to use the later editions. The latest edition of 72 is actually the 2013 edition, depending on the jurisdiction. Slide 40, please. Okay, so what exactly is needed? And this will depend usually on the occupancy. And again, the higher level codes and standards, laws rather, and ADA are the driving force for this. And of course, the possibilities include audible, tone, which includes tone and voice, visible, which can include strobes or textual displays such as digital signs and so on, and often both is required. I have a notation here about off-site forces notification. I have that in because typically that's considered part of occupant notification or notification requirements in general, I should say. And that means there's a signal sent off-site to call the fire department. So we're not going to go any further than that, but that's one of the things that is framed within the rules of the higher level codes and standards. Slide 41, please. Now, there are two types, well, actually, let's go through. There's, as far as the types of audible notification, there is two different operating modes which are cited in the code. There's private mode and public mode. And Jim sort of alluded to that a little bit earlier, but what that means, a public mode means if signal isn't intended for the general occupants of the building, that's called a public mode signal. So when a person hears or sees something that would indicate that they need to evacuate or relocate, then they take the action through their means to do that. Private mode is where you're signaling to certain individuals, such as, for example, the case that Jim talked about, a nurse's station. It's signaling to those who need to take action, further action to implement emergency procedures. Now, audible signals, and I'm making this distinction here, but signals like tones as opposed to a voice can be chimes, bells, horns, or speakers. The code NFK72 does not dictate what kind of equipment that has to be. Typically, they're horns, but you can use other things. One of the things that we have to be careful of, or that the code specifies for audible signals, is something called audibility, which is the sound pressure level or loudness of that audible signal. And lastly, another type is voice communication, which would be speakers. In some cases, you may have a facility like in a high-rise building where the evacuation plan requires people to partially evacuate or relocate. And in order to accommodate the facility to do that, a voice communication system needs to be installed so you can instruct people what to do. And in that case, what we're concerned about is something called intelligibility, not audibility. And I think the next slide might speak to that. Let me just see. 42, please. No, it doesn't talk about it, but there is a slide coming up, so we'll talk about what intelligibility is. So audibility, the general requirements that are in NFK 72, the average ambient sound level, if it's that's the level of noise in the background, if it's greater than 105 dBA, the code requires visible signaling to be provided. And the term average ambient sound level is a technical term that's defined in the code. I have the reference there. We don't need to get into that level of detail here, but it is a term that is defined and in some cases makes a difference on how the requirement is applied. Also, the total sound pressure level, which would be the ambient background plus alarm, cannot exceed 120 dBA. Now, that's what's in the 2002 code. In later editions, it's been changed to 110 dBA to coincide with the OSHA requirements. And the other thing of note here is that the sound pressures levels that NFPA 72 talks about are using the A-weighted scale. That's what the A stands for in dBA. And what that does is it compensates for the typical hearing levels where, at least for normal folks, the hearing drops off at low levels and high levels. Of course, people with hearing deficits have a whole different problem, but that's what that dBA stands for. We did have a couple questions concerning situations where the loudness of the fire alarm system was considered to, you know, interfering with people's ability to communicate over communication systems, such as in area of refuge situation, or in a stairwell where you have a lot of reverberation. In those situations, the first thing I guess I would check is the sound level too high? Is the level, and that could be the case. As far as the stairwells are concerned, NFPA 101 and NFPA 72 have an exemption for the alarm signal in exit stairways. Now, exit stairways are not ordinary stairways. That's a specific term used in building and occupancy codes. So that's part of the egress path leaving the building. But if you have a stairway that's not part of an exit, an egress or exit stairway system, then those exemptions would not apply. Slide 43, please. Okay, now continuing on with public mode requirements for audibility. Basically, there are two criteria that you have in general. The criteria is that your alarm signal has to be 15 dB above average ambient sound level, or 5 dB above the maximum sound pressure level having a duration of at least 60 minutes. Now, the reason that we use dB and not dBA is because it's measuring the difference, and the A part cancels out. So that's the nature of that. The measurement of this sound pressure level is measured 5 feet above the floor. Next slide, please. So basically, I might have moved ahead just a little bit. You have a choice on the previous slide. You have to take the worst of which of the two cases, 15 dBA above average ambient or 5 dBA above the maximum. Whichever is worst is the rule that you have to apply. Now, the general public mode audibility requirements also include allowances to reduce or eliminate audible signals, but they have to be approved by the AHJ, and in those cases, you must use visible signaling. The classic example there is a operating room in a hospital. You certainly don't want the surgeon having to listen to a loud audible signal if he's doing surgery. It might not be a good idea. So that's one example. Also, there's an allowance in the public mode requirements for audibility that you can use the private mode for elevators and bathrooms, and we're going to talk about what private mode means in another slide or two. Also, there's an allowance to stop or reduce ambient noise, and also that must be approved by the AHJ and use visible signaling. And that's a great application for something like a nightclub or in a situation where it's just too hard to overcome the ambient noise level, so you're allowed to pull the plug on the band, so to speak. Next slide, please. Okay, now we're talking about private mode. And private mode is again, the requirements are fairly similar. You notice the two criteria are fairly similar, except instead of 15 dB for public mode, you have 10 dB for private mode. So it allows it to be a bit quieter, but it's got to be a private mode application, not a public mode application. Again, we still measure 5 feet above the floor, and there's, again, an allowance to reduce or eliminate the audible signal if it's approved and a visible signal is used, and you can also stop or reduce it just like you can for public mode. Slide 46, please. Now, there's a third audibility criteria that is applies. If you're dealing with a sleeping area, you go back to the public mode requirements, 15 dBA and 5 dB, and add a third one. It has to be a minimum of 75 dBA. So in the case of sleeping areas, you actually have three criterias that apply, and you have to pick the greater of the three. And in that case, we measure at the pillow level, and also there's a code provision that requires that be measured with any doors or barriers in place so that if there's any attenuation that can be accounted for. Next slide, please. I think we are one too far. There you go. Um, the audibility requirements, the specific requirements, they have a specific listed wall-mounted requirement if you're using an audible device. The default requirement is that it must be the appliance, the top of it must be 90 inches above the finished floor and 6 inches below the ceiling. If you're using a combination horn strobe, you follow the requirements for the visible signaling, which are outlined in 754, and we'll talk about those in a few minutes. The reason for this 90 and 6-inch value is mainly to avoid general, blocking the sound with general furnishings, so they want to try to get it up high. You can use listed ceiling-mounted audible appliances in addition to the listed wall-mounted. And now the spacing. One of the questions we had asked the question, what's the difference between performance-based and prescriptive requirements? And this is actually a good example of performance-based requirements. NFPA 72 doesn't tell you exactly where the audible appliances must be located. They can actually be located, aside from the mounting height, they can actually be located anywhere as long as the minimum dBA or dB level is provided, as we talked about in the earlier slide. So as long as you meet those sound pressure levels, you can actually mount them anywhere. So in that sense, it's a performance-based kind of rule. When we get into the visible, it's the examples that we have there and the requirements are actually very prescriptive. And with that, let's move to slide 48. I'm just making a note here. The code, I think actually it was a 2002 edition, added a section on narrowband tone signaling. Now, that is a performance-based type of arrangement where you actually have to do calculations to look at various frequencies. The high frequencies can mask out the low frequencies and so forth, and it requires a narrowband analysis. So I don't want to get into that much more, but I wanted to make note of that because there are some options in difficult situations, especially where you have a noisy background, that you can overcome using this narrowband tone signaling technique. Slide 49. Okay, voice communications. We alluded to that earlier. The main thing on voice communications is you need to have voice intelligibility, which basically means you want the output of your speaker systems to be free from distortion, capable of being understood. Now, there's some guidance that's provided in the annex that I've noted there. I do want to reiterate, it's not the same as audibility. And very often, making a sound system for voice louder reduces the voice intelligibility. So you need to pay attention to that if you're doing a voice system. And the requirements and guidance for voice communication systems are completely updated in the 2010 and 2013 editions of the code. We'll talk about that later, but if you're doing any of that, it's well worth your time to take a look at those later editions because it's the requirements are night and day from what's in the 2002 edition. Slide 50, please. So the types of visible notification include the same sort of thing, operating modes, public and private mode. In case of private mode for visible, that's what you would have for the displays on control units, or other things that are not intended for the general public. Public mode visible signaling, we have two types. Indirect viewing, which is the typical requirements that the code has for the spacing of strobes in a room. And we have direct viewing, which is what we have in corridors. Now, just to explain, indirect viewing means that if you're occupied with a task and you're not necessarily paying attention to the strobes or your environment, the strobes that are provided have to provide enough intensity of reflected light to draw your attention. And that's what the tables in the code are based on. For direct viewing, it has to be a situation like in a corridor where you're basically looking directly ahead, maybe walking along, but you're not preoccupied with some sort of task. And you are able to physically directly see the visible appliance without any obstruction. And the third type of visible notification is the textual and graphical displays. So let's see, let's go to slide 51, please. Okay, the basic requirements for strobes are outlined in 752 and 753 of the 2002 edition. The flash rate must be between 1 and 2 flashes per second. The color must be clear or white. And it has to be listed to ANSI UL 1971, signaling for safety signaling devices for the hearing impaired. That's the name of the standard. And a footnote here is the strobe ratings are given as an effective intensity CD. So when we get into the tables, we'll see those listings. Slide 52, please. So wall-mounted strobes. The mounting requirements are in 7.5.4. And basically, the bottom of the lens of the strobe must be at least 80 inches above the floor, and the top of the lens of the strobe must not be more than 96 inches above the floor. And the reason that's important is that the tables that are outlined in the code on the spacing that you have for your strobes assume a certain intensity, and when the strobe is firing, it's doing so with something called a polar distribution. And as you go off direct axis, the intensity changes. So it's important to get the strobes lined up within those specifications. Actually, there is, in the later editions of the code, there's some ways to adjust the output of the strobe if you end up like in a situation where you have a low ceiling and you can't meet those requirements. There's some provisions in the code that cover how to adjust the output so it properly coincides with the performance that's intended. Now for indirect viewing, the spacing is the tables that we have in the code. Yeah, actually, let's go ahead and move to the next slide, please, on 53. Now this is a direct snapshot of one of the parts of the code. This is the spacing table for wall-mounted strobes. And you notice the highlighted locations. These are the minimum required light outputs and maximum room size. And there's a column for one light per room. The other two columns, personally, I never use them because they're just it's just not necessary. It's much simpler to deal with a one light per room specification. So if we go to the next slide, I have the left side of the code there kind of expanded. So there you can see the required output in Candela for different sizes of rooms. So, and each room is treated as a square in this table. So naturally, in order to get the right effect, you have to locate the strobe on the center of the wall. And if we go to the next slide, please. As I noted, the table assumes square rooms, and at least for the wall-mounted appliances, it's assumed that you're mounting halfway along the wall so that you get, you know, full effect of the square. The code has some details in it that talks about if you're not halfway along the wall, how do you adjust the size of the room to compensate for that. The code does address that, but basically if you think of this as an imaginary square, it's a much simpler way to look at it anyway. So let's take a look at the next slide for an example of square room configuration. This is right out of the code. And as you can see, the visible appliance is in the center of the wall, and they show some various room sizes, but in each case, we're located in the center. Slide 57, please. Okay, so for non-square or large rooms, the code section that's highlighted there talks about basically subdividing the area or using sort of an imaginary square that will fit the circumstance that you might have. So if you have a non-square room, if you draw an imaginary square around it and size the strobe for that imaginary square, then you're covered. The next two slides show different examples of that. Slide 58, please. Okay, there's an example of a non-square room, and you can see the hyphenated dotted line there shows the square that could be superimposed around that non-square room to account for an irregular space, and then you just size the strobe to accommodate that larger square. Next slide, please. In this case here, this would be an example of a larger space, and the 50 feet is no particular limit. This, you could have an unlimited space, but you just divide the area into some imaginary squares and locate the strobes accordingly. So that's how you do, and these are actually showing for wall-mounted strobes. Slide 60, please. Ceiling-mounted strobes. So far we've been talking about wall-mounted, but you can use ceiling-mounted strobes. They have to be listed for ceiling mount, and the location of those can be actually mounted on the ceiling itself or suspended below the ceiling. And for indirect viewing, which is the normal room spacing, you use the spacing table that we're going to show next. And the maximum height above the floor is 30 feet. So if you have a very high ceiling, you basically have to suspend the strobe, the ceiling-mounted strobe, below the ceiling to a point where it's not more than 30 feet above the floor. Next slide, please. Slide 61. And here's the table for the ceiling-mounted strobes, very similar to the other table. You'll notice this one has an additional column called the maximum ceiling height. And so for a given size room and given ceiling height, you have a list of acceptable strobe levels. And you can see where I've got it highlighted there, the breakpoint where it changes from 10 to 20 to 30 feet. So the code does not have anything that addresses mounting ceiling strobes above 30 feet. That's why you have to make sure that you're at least that low. slide 62, please. And similar to wall-mounted strobes, the maximum room size for ceiling-mounted strobes also assumes that the strobe is mounted at the center of the room. If the room is not square or very large, the same kind of rules apply. You subdivide the room into squares that'll work. Slide 63, please. We're up one. Can we go to, yeah, there we go. Performance-based alternatives, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I did want to note that because you have this prescriptive tables in the code, in some cases, it may be easier to use a performance-based alternative, which basically means you're going to calculate the light output based on the polar distribution for the strobe using the inverse square law. And you have to do your calculation to show that you're going to get a minimum of 0.0375 lumens per square foot illumination throughout the covered area. So that's an option that you have rather than using the prescriptive spacing rules. It can come in handy in certain situations. Slide 64, please. For direct viewing, as I mentioned, this is the case where you have, you're looking basically straight ahead, and that's typically what you'd be doing in a corridor. The rules in 7542 basically require that the corridor be not less than, not more than 20 feet wide. You can use 15 candela strobes. You can also use larger ones, but the minimum you can use is 15. They have to be spaced every 100 feet maximum, and there has to be a strobe within 15 feet of the end of the corridor. And if you have any interruption in viewing path, say, for example, if the corridor turns a corner, then you have to treat that as a new corridor. And the next slide gives an example of how that works. As you can see, there's several corridors there with different configurations, and the locations of the visible appliances are shown that work. Slide 66, please. Synchronization. Basically, it's actually simpler than a lot of people think. Basically, the rule is if you have more than two strobes in the same room or space within the same field of view, they're required to be synchronized. If you have two or less, they do not have to be synchronized. Slide 67, please. Sleeping areas. There's, for visible notification, you have special rules. You still have to comply, if you're using wall-mounted strobes, they still have to comply with the mounting requirements that we talked about earlier in 754. However, they must be located within 16 feet of the pillow in the sleeping room. And they must be high-intensity strobes. Now, depending on where they're mounted in accordance with the normal mounting rules, if you're within 24 inches of the ceiling, you have to use a 177 candela strobe. If they're greater than 24 inches from the ceiling, you can use a 110 candela strobe. Slide 68, please. Now, in the 2010 and later edition of NFPA 72, they added something that system designers were really happy to see. The provisions that talk about when you need to synchronize strobes formally talked about just synchronizing two or more strobes. Now they talk about synchronizing groups of synchronized strobes. So if you have, for example, multiple groups of synchronized strobes, the rule would apply the same way as if it was an individual strobe. So you can have up to two groups of synchronized strobes where the strobes in each group are synchronized, and then the individuals, the two separate groups would not have to be synchronized together. So hopefully that's clear. I think the slide's fairly clear. The other note here is that it has to include any strobes for any system in the area. So if you have a fire alarm system and an emergency communication system, all those strobes have to be considered. Next slide, please. Slide 69. Okay, so in the next couple slides, we're going to talk about what's some of the major changes in the code since the 2002 edition. One of them is in the 2002 edition, we have these requirements for low-frequency audible signals. Now, there's two provisions in the code to talk about that, one for commercial space and one for household like smoke alarms and so on. The audible appliances for sleeping areas, effective January 1st, 2014, have to have a frequency of 520 hertz, plus or minus 10%, fundamental frequency, and be a square wave or have equivalent awakening ability. Now, the square wave basically gives you harmonics that are helpful in influencing people with various grades of hearing loss at different frequencies. But it's been found that the 520 hertz fundamental frequency is effective for most folks that have hearing loss. Of course, it doesn't apply for profound hearing loss, which you'd still need a strobe for that. Also, it works for people that have maybe on medications and that sort of thing. So it's proven to be very effective. And so that's going to be for commercial sleeping areas, or sleeping areas in commercial systems, I should say, effective January 1st, 2014. Next slide, please. For household, it's a similar rule, but it applies immediately. It doesn't have the retroactive requirement, and it applies to those with mild to severe hearing loss. And for the case where you have moderately severe to profound hearing loss, you still need strobes, and you also need tactile appliances. So this would be in situations where you're installing smoke alarms or household fire alarm systems. Slide 71, please. Also, a major update I alluded to earlier was new requirements and guidance for voice intelligibility. There's a new term defined for doing that in the code called acoustically distinguishable space. I know we're getting short on time, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but it has to do with how you design the space and identify the information on the design plans. And there's a new Annex D that gives a tremendous amount of guidance on how to do all that. Slide 72, please. There's new design requirements for audible appliances and for visible appliances in the 2013 edition of the code, which require the designer to be very specific about the spaces, the audibility levels, the expected ambient sound levels, and all of that has to be documented and provided to the authority having jurisdiction if requested. Slide 73. And also in the 2010 and later editions of the code, we have quite a large piece of requirements specified for how you do textual and graphical displays, such as text displays. So the character height, the types of characters, the locations, power supplies, there's a whole slew of information there that was new in the 2010 edition. Slide 74. Okay, I'll turn it back to Peggy.
Yes, thank you, Lee. Thank you very much. That was a great review of, in a lot of detail, that those of you who came to the session wanting to get some more specifics on NFPA 72 certainly had that information delivered. We really appreciate that. So we have just a little bit of time here for some questions. And to give you a little break from speaking, at least for a moment, I want to go through a couple questions that came in the chat room, and then I know both of you got some questions in advance that we can maybe go back to as well. But one question, Lee, that someone had here was about what the pillow level in a dormitory-like space, like a homeless shelter, where bunk beds are common. What is the pillow level?
Well, I guess that I think the pillow lover's level is simply wherever the pillow is. There's no definition of what pillow level is. So I guess if you're designing a space before there's any furnishings in there, you kind of have to know what's going to be put in. If you're going to be using bunk beds and that sort of thing, then you have to be able to use the worst case. And that, in that case, to me, I would think that would be probably the lower level, but perhaps not. It's not a defined term. I don't know if I can do any better than that with the question.
Okay, thanks. And another question was, is the DB level measured at 5 feet above the floor, directly below the audible notification appliance?
No, that's 5 feet above the floor anywhere in the occupiable area. So in other words, the requirement is to have so many dBA above average ambient or maximum, or if it's in a bedroom, the 75 minimum, measured throughout that space. So any space in the occupancy would have to meet those requirements.
Okay. Let's see, a few more questions that came in here. This might be one for Jim. In facilities where offices where members of the public may attend meetings, are audible and visual alarms required?
Well, basically, when you get the public that are allowed to come into a space, for the most part, you now become a public area, and public areas in new construction are required to be accessible with regards to the alarm system. We get this request with regards to if you go into doctor's offices, clearly the treatment rooms are public spaces. The toilet rooms are public spaces. The lobby is public spaces. But then you get to the doctor's office, and then the question becomes, is that a public space or is it an employee-only space? And the question becomes, how is it used? If the doctor treats people and talks to people and consults with people in the treatment room and then goes back to his or her office and does, you know, writes up things, and that's, the public never goes back into his or her office, the office is a work area. If, on the other hand, he allows the public to come in after being examined and come in there and to converse with them and talk about the treatment options and basically consult in his office just became a public area and is now required to comply.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Lee, did you have any other questions that came in advance that you weren't able to address in your presentation?
Well, I actually had several of them that I didn't, but let me answer the question that came in that says, how does the unit smoke detector interface with the building fire alarm system? What are battery backup requirements? I guess I'm not sure what a unit smoke detector is, but I'm going to assume that we are talking about like an apartment building situation, where you have requirements in the building code for smoke alarms in those apartments, and also you have requirements for system fire alarm system throughout the building. Now, the one of the things that people don't realize is that a smoke alarm and a smoke detector are two different things. So the code has specific requirements for either of those, but typically, and often the building code, and I know 72 will allow you to use system smoke detectors and notification appliances in lieu of smoke alarms, and as long as they're configured the same way the code requires for the smoke alarms. Now, typically, you're not going to have the smoke alarms in the individual apartments sound alarm throughout the building. So you can connect them through contact modules to the building fire alarm system, but they have to be connected in a way that they will be recognized as supervisory signals rather than alarm signals. And supervisory signals is just a different type of signal that the code talks about. But in that way, the building management or the fire department can see the supervisory signal on the fire alarm control panel, and it will not it won't set off the building fire alarm system. The battery backup requirements for this building system is 24 hours, and that's the case for all commercial systems. And battery backup for the smoke alarms is 7 days, I believe. If you buy a listed smoke alarm, you're going to get it with that, as long as you maintain the battery replacements and so on.
I'm seeing a question here just about compliance, and one question is, do authorities make actual measurements of the sound and light levels to check compliance?
The question on synchronization. Authorities, let me first explain that synchronization of strobes is something that happens with systems, not necessarily with smoke alarms. I'm not sure that the strobes on smoke alarms would actually synchronize. But for systems, they're required to. We talked about the requirement, and the way that's typically done is through the control panel to which they're connected. The testing of whether they're synchronized or not, I think I've never been asked that question before, but it seems like it would be fairly obvious if they're not flashing in unison. They'd be just randomly flashing, and that wouldn't be a good thing if you had more than two strobes in the area. As far as the light level, the light level is not required to be tested. What is required is that the CD strobe rating, the candela level that's designed by the system designer, has to be checked to make sure it's at the right level when the system is put in place. The decibel level for audible appliances is measured during the initial installation, and depending on the addition of the code, it's also done periodically. Later editions of the code don't require that particular step unless there's been a change, and the building has been remodeled or something like that, where it might affect the sound level.
Okay, and probably, Lee, if you have one more question, we probably only have time for one more question on your list of questions that came in advance. Go for that.
Here's one that talked about if the building loses power, there's a short time duration, 30 to 60 seconds before the backup system kicks in. And that's actually, if you have required diesel generators for your building, typically they're required to be within 10 seconds. But nonetheless, NFPA 72 requires that if you're using a diesel generator kind of a backup, that you also have a backup battery dedicated to the fire alarm system to carry it over, and the capacity of that has to be at least 4 hours. Most fire alarm systems use their own dedicated backup batteries, which require 24 hours of capacity, regardless of what might be in the system for diesels and that sort of thing. So, in short, if you install it in compliance with NFPA 72, you should be good.
Great. Thank you, Lee, and we really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to impart your knowledge on us. And I want to thank Jim also for his presentation. And at this point, I'll turn it back over to Jessica.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for your wealth of knowledge today on this very important topic. For those of you who are in the webinar room, we just want to provide you with contact information for the Access Board. And thank you for participating in today's webinar. Our next session is going to be July 11th, a date change due to the holiday, and we will be covering Section 508, Accessible Web Content. If your question was not addressed during the session, you do have the contact information for the Access Board to follow up with them. That concludes today's session. Thank you very much for joining us. To exit the system, you can click on the red X in the top right-hand corner. Have a great rest of your afternoon.